Okay, it is February 5th, 2020. We're here at the Research Center for Nonviolence. We have a crowd of about 15 people, including Anthony Prince, Carol Denny, James, Keith, Kevin, Angel, Gloria, Fox.
And for people that don't know, I helped start the original Food Not Bombs 4 years ago, and I was elected treasurer of the Santa Cruz Homeless Union. And I've been helping start the Pomona Homeless Union and the protest that is happening all day, every day outside the Claremont City Council by the Claremont Homeless Union, which is going really well. So anyway, how many unions do we have?
Well, my name is Anthony Prince. So I'm with the California Homeless Union, and we're getting to the point, as it was in the traditional trade union movement starting in this country, where we're averse to disclosing just how many members and how many locals, because we're growing.
Yeah,
a lot of our leadership is increasingly being targeted for that reason. So, but I say that we have, in California, between 10 and 25 local unions or local unions in formation, and we're part of the national union of the homeless, which Keith and I both go back to 30 years ago. And we have, in about 15 or 20 cities across the United States, fledgling homeless union locals, and in some cases more than fledgling. Some have been around for 2 or 3 years. And we can talk more about that, but yeah.
Right.
So I'm happy to hear about Claremont and Pomona.
Yeah, they're great.
I didn't get your first name.
Anthony,
thank you.
Okay, so maybe we could go, wow, technology. So then, Kevin, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Kevin Rothwell. I'm a 30-something year Santa Cruz resident.
James, I'm a 26-year Santa Cruz County resident. And recently decided to make civic duty almost a full-time job.
Right on.
Okay. I'll introduce myself, Anthony Prince.
My name is Fox. I'm a lifelong, so far, Santa Cruz resident for a mystery amount of years. And, yeah, here's this pen, by the way. It was going with this.
And I'm Dick Vitto. That's V-I-T-T-I-T-O-W. Guess I'm the first Vitto you've ever seen.
The first what?
Vitto you've ever seen.
Vitto?
I think that's
Vitto.
Nope. I'm Marion, O-N, Marion, and I'm the second Vitto, so he's already lost it. Here I am. We've been here for 25 years now.
I'm from California, but I moved to Santa Cruz 12 years ago, and my name is Maggie.
Oh, hi, Seth. I've lived here for, 94 when I was just May High, and now I'm a college student, so I'm really excited getting out there and doing stuff.
How do you get your name, honey?
Seth. I'm Laura. I got here in 89 from Monterey County. I have some lived experience as homeless as a child and as a young adult in Monterey County, and then here 23 years ago, just have been hanging out with these yahoos. whatever, I'm not very, that's me.
I'm Barbara Fields, and I have lived in Santa Cruz since I retired 10 years ago, and I was a welfare activist over in the Central Valley that dealt with the homeless and getting them a permanent shelter with HUD, from HUD, and finding places for them to sleep in the wintertime. and especially when the Armory was closed, they had nowhere to go, and I found Walmart Church for one, and then I found a Grange Hall for them to sleep in, and I'm really concerned about finding some permanent housing or semi-permanent housing, little houses or something, on a campground or on some land. We have to do something. You know, we can't just keep doing this, what we're doing in Santa Cruz, which is just shuffling them around and hoping they'll leave. You know, we've got to do something substantial. And I'm here.
I'm Gloria Robey, and I've been living in the Santa Cruz area for 30 years. Before that was Monterey.
I'm Robert Norris, and I'm interested in organizing different kinds of protests that focus on city officials and county officials and others who are responsible primarily for the gentrification in the area and the criminalization of poor people. So I work with a group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every Wednesday. And on Tuesday, we're doing a protest serving coffee to homeless folks at 7:45 in the morning.
Sure.
Is that 7:30? I don't know.
7:30, 7:45.
We're going to be at the city manager's office demanding that Martine Bernal is the real powerful official in the city, stop harassing encampments, and allow the kind of encampments that perhaps Alicia will tell you about to resume its work.
Right.
Sorry about that.
No, that sounds great. And I loved the meeting you guys had today. Thanks for letting me sit in. I'm Carol Denny. I was born in East LA, and Santa Cruz was my first choice as a UC college campus, but they sent me to Berkeley. So I've been there playing music and doing art, music, and humor ever since, and working on housing issues for a long time.
I'm Angel. I was born in Fresno, grew up in Santa Cruz. I'm an activist. I'm part of the Santa Cruz 11. I'm the vice president of the Santa Cruz chapter of the California Homeless Union. I am homeless, and I'm angry that we are having to deal with this. I'm passionate to try to do something to fix it.
I'm Jesse from Santa Cruz.
Who?
Jesse.
I'm Alicia Poole. I am the president of the Santa Cruz chapter of the California Homeless Union. I'm also the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. I work with unhoused individuals in San Jose as well as here in Santa Cruz. I was the Ross Camp liaison. I helped to prepare the Ross Camp Council, get a council going on there so that people could have a voice within that council or within that encampment, and also have a voice to try to change policy. I was one of the people that helped in drawing up the pro se lawsuit. We were saying that if you don't have an alternative placement, please do not displace the people from this camp, regardless if it's not, you know, a beauteous spot. I do believe that it could have been better with some support from the city. I, with Keith McHenry with Food Not Bombs and all of our people in the Santa Cruz chapter of the California Homeless Union, we prepared a camp proposal. We lost a friend back in October. She was a officer of the Homeless Union, Desiree Quintero. She was killed while seeking refuge in her camp in the Poganip. She was one of the people that was not offered alternative shelter when they did close the Ross camp. And so, in her memory, back in November, we reopened the former Ross Camp location in the name of Camp Phoenix. We were successful in keeping it open for 5 days. We had 5 basic rules. When they did come and shut us down, it was kind of a secret because we didn't know that they were coming. They put out all week long that they had no tools to take care of it. It was kind of a Martin versus Boise situation, and then all of a sudden they stormed in and displaced about 70 people without, again, offering them alternative shelter. And so on a daily basis, I see the suffering here in Santa Cruz. I help replenish through donations all the winter supplies that are being swept from people constantly. I get phone calls at all hours of the night by people that have lost their belongings. They might need a blanket or they might need a resource. It's basically my full-time job, paid and unpaid, to help people that are suffering from poverty and being unhoused right now. And the criminalization here in Santa Cruz is a big problem. We do need to find some solutions rather than the historical shuffling people around and acting like, you know, if we make it really harsh here for them to exist, they'll just go away. So I fight against that.
Okay. And then you're newer to here, yes?
Yeah, hi.
What's your name?
I'm Bree Bolton.
And did you get to sign our contact list?
Not yet.
Okay.
It's coming.
And I forgot to introduce my new emotional support animal, Freedom.
Oh.
She's 8 weeks old, teacup chihuahua.
I had also forgot to mention, I can't stay for the whole meeting. But I came specifically because I'm interested in the tiny house idea. So I was wondering if we can...
So we invited Carol... who we've worked with for like at least 30 years on these issues. Carol and I did like an action when they were spraying down people in front of Cody's bookstore where we we went in our bathing suit and got in a
little pool
and we sat
and there. We had a plastic lobster.
Yeah. The photos of that are great. Yeah.
And to protest the way we called it Cody's Recreational Water Sports Program. And Pat and Fred Cody were great people and their bookstore was a great place, but it had been bought by Andy Ross.
Yeah.
And he really was the opposite of Fred Cody, who specifically designed his building to have places for people to panhandle and bring things they would like to sell. And he just was clear that that was a part of Berkeley's street culture, and he was fine with it. But Andy had his water sports program where if you were sleeping there in the morning, oh boy, a hose of cold water is how it would greet you. So I forgot completely that we did that together.
Yeah, and then that the naked people came and danced it around us.
They would spray people.
Yeah, they would go with like a little tractor type thing.
Yeah,
with
they had a
hose thing, and they would just spray all the people sitting on the sidewalk.
They still do that in Berkeley.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
No, we became allies with our sprayer guy here because he became homeless.
Excellent strategy.
And he now loves us, and every time I used to yell at us and stuff, but now he waves to me and yells, "Food up!"
So how do we go about...
Could I start?
Yeah.
If you
let's
don't
jump
mind,
right to
what
yeah.
I wanted to
go
do, and then I'll talk about tiny homes. How about that, Andy? But I wanted to do a song first, if that's okay.
Right on.
Okay, so this is a cranky. A cranky is a paper movie, and you paint a lot of pictures to illustrate your song, and then you scroll it from one side to the other. So if you can't see well enough, you can just get a little closer and get in front of it. But basically, I'm going to roll it this way and just sing the song. Usually I force some poor person in the audience to do their cranking for me because I'm playing the guitar or the English concertina.
James.
But this one's really short. But the thing is, I wrote it because we were off to get arrested somewhere, and we were either in my truck or yours, I can't remember. And today at the Huff meeting, I think it was you, James, who said, well, they can't ticket you repeatedly for the same thing. And I remember sitting in the truck, and that's what I said to you, because Keith had magically gotten at least 5 or maybe more than that, all these tickets for the same moment in time, on his same truck, on the same day, in different locations. And I said, well, that can't happen. And he goes, but look, and he had this big smile on his face. And then he said, how does that happen? And he said, first they arrest you and throw you in jail. And it sounded like a song to me, so I think I said something like, track all your phones and then jack up your bail. And then he looked back at me and he said, because they're so in love. And I thought, this is even greater than the song I was coming up with. And I said, they can't get you out of their mind. So that is the way this song begins. And I'll just sing it for you. So here it starts. Here we go. First they arrest you and throw you in jail. Track all your phones and then jack up your bail. Cause they're so in love, they can't get you out of their minds. Well, they're watching your house and they follow your car. They're tracking your movements wherever you are. Cause they're so, everybody, in love, they can't get you out of their minds. Your name's in the paper about every day, and you're quoted as saying stuff you never say, and you're suddenly charged with a whole lot of crimes. And you have to make court dates a whole lot of times. It's because, everybody, they're in love. What else could it possibly be? It happens because they're in love with you, the way they're all in love with me.
YouTube, if you want to keep watching it.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
That was so
That's
cute.
Yeah.
So I guess one of the things we were just talking about is like, we know what the solutions to having people forced to sleep on the street are. Not a mystery, not rocket science. Don't have to wait till we're on another planet. We're so lucky that we know, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's the political divisions and the greed and the ways that maybe you, for some reason, who was it? In your letter, like, for some reason, I never signed up for the office hours you said you'd have. You know, getting through to your politicians is often very difficult. But humor is one of our tools. And so is dance, and so is starting your own newspaper. We had so many newspapers at People's Park. I mean, we had at least 5, including the Cop Watch report. So we had humorous ones. We had, like, want to know what happened on the street last week to your friends and the people that you love. We really did our best to take our creative spirit and pour it hard on the places in which we overlap and we can organize together. So I guess that's what my focus has been for a long time. So a lot of my friends are mad at me because I'm not a big fan of tiny homes. So I'm going to cover this just so we can cover it, because I'm glad to talk about it. Oh!
You're the only
one. It's lonely!
Me.
Isn't it lonely?
I'm not a big
Well, let me just tell you. So if you don't know what a tiny home is, it's generally a substandard amount of space.
Right.
It generally has no bathroom. It has no heating. It doesn't have to have a window. And these things historically were born on college campuses. Oh, and could you, anybody who just came in, I'm glad to give you one of these. So tiny homes were born on college campuses. People walked in. Here we go. That's for you. They were born so that people could demonstrate the difference between Italianate housing and Dutch colonial. You could literally, without having to build an entire house, show your professor that not only did you know the difference, you could make some like cunning filigree in your woodworking class. This was never intended for human habitation. And the way I can prove that is that California, go to the State of California website and you will find habitability standards.
Mm-hmm.
And ours are getting dumbed down, but still, we still maintain habitability standards that are better than jail. Jail, you don't have to have a window. California habitability standards, you do. You have to have a window. You have to have heat. You have to have a door that locks behind you. You have to have a lot of things, and certain square footage. You have to have a lot of things that they have decided are the bare minimum we're going to ask from developers. And those constraints are important because if you give developers an inch, and they've started to do that, they will make micro units. They have all kinds of things. The tiny homes is one thing. The micro units is another thing. Oh, we don't really need a window here, do we? They'll try to see if they can get a much bigger bite of the apple. And it makes a difference. A lot of people, if you put them in a constrained space, will go a little nuts. There are really good reasons why we have at least the standards we have. But there's another reason. And this is my favorite reason why I'm the one who says no to tiny homes, although it beats living behind the dumpster. Yeah. I checked my own city, Berkeley, and we have the count that they use is 1,000 people on the street. The real count is about 2,000, but you know how that works. They usually undercount, and they never count people who are doubled up on the front sofa and stuff like that. So make it about 2,000. Well, on any night, and I check this probably every 3 months. I just go, like, Berkeley, how many Airbnb places are there in Berkeley? And there's usually about 5,000. 5,000. And that's not the only, like, what do they call those things? They call it sharing, but it's not. It's monetizing, you know, a private home. So that's not counting the other platforms that do that same thing. And it's also not counting the empty commercial spaces.
Yeah.
And oh boy, do we have tons of those. Some of it's money from a foreign country just sitting there as an investment. I live on a street where right down the street from me, there is 5 stories of what was up to about 6 months ago, completely empty apartment buildings with 5 commercial spaces, completely empty for 10 years. So I used that in my comedy, and I used to go to the city council and just say, I got an idea. I'm a homeowner. Sort of technically, we started a nonprofit and took over a building in a rent strike, so now I can kind of say that. And we got some empty buildings right near me, and I would be happy to be the liaison between anybody you got who needs a roof and just make sure things are straight in there. Please, will you work with me and the property owner and do things like that? Because I gotta say, why are they sitting empty if this is in Berkeley declared to be a housing crisis? It's officially a housing crisis. So when they, you know, we get this new mayor, Mayor Jesse Adagin, he officially declares it a housing crisis. And right after that, he took every promise he had made to those of us who worked for his election. Campgrounds and like safe spaces for people who are living in their cars, safe spaces for our, like we worked for 2 years on a plan, and he torched it as soon as he got into office.
We've pleaded with our city council to help us on numerous occasions.
Louder, please.
We've pleaded with our city, Santa Cruz City Council, on numerous occasions to help us, and we've gotten pretty much nowhere. Actually, the opposite.
It's getting worse.
That's why we were considering tiny housing as an option.
I fully agree with you about the tiny housing. I'm worried that they're going to be like $1,500 for this tiny little place.
Yeah.
Like, we'll have no control over the rent.
Like,
and the next thing
temporary.
You know, the standard will go down,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, but no rent caps. So what we're charging now for like a one bedroom, we'll now charge on these tiny little places that are like less for
I
more.
I share that concern.
Is what's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, if I could just address both of you at once. I think a lot of people start, they look at those things, and first of all, there's the cute factor.
Right.
Whoa, little curtains, and like, it reminds you of the dollhouse and all this. And they think, you know, that this somehow will be easier because it's smaller. They think that somehow this will be more acceptable. And sometimes it is. Sometimes you end up creating at least a space out of the rain. You know, and I'm not saying that is something that I wouldn't take if I was behind the dumpster. I'm just saying our city, the city of Berkeley, is among the top 10 in income disparity in the nation. When we know they could take half of what's on Airbnb right now, and they've got the budget to rent all of them, house everyone overnight. They just don't want to spend the money. So why don't they want to spend the money? Why don't they? We have families, you know. I know you guys have the same thing. We have families. We have kids in school who spend the night in a vehicle. Over 2,000 in San Francisco. Our count's pretty high.
We've been hearing in Oakland and a couple other places, people are starting to just put tiny houses.
Just put them up. Just put them up.
Do you know how they're able to...
Yes, I do.
Can you tell how does that to go?
Okay.
And I'm curious as to know is how they're getting away with it.
Yeah.
And like, if you know, where those resources are coming from.
Okay.
Something that maybe we can utilize here.
Okay. And I'm going to give you my card so that we can talk further too.
Okay, yeah.
If you have more questions, anybody who wants one. But I'm going to tell you just briefly about the group Mothers for Housing.
Yeah.
You may have seen some
of
this on TV.
Yeah.
Oakland.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was really beautifully organized. They had 5-star legal assistants to do a housing takeover. 4 black mothers, you know, some with babies, okay? So, and they chose, the property they chose was very carefully chosen to be a property that had sat empty a long time and belonged to a huge corporation that was planning to do nothing with it. In other words, that corporation could have rented to them, didn't want to, wanted it to sit empty because, hey, it just sits there safe and it's an investment. So that was beautifully chosen. That's an array of elements that craft, plus they were so ready for the public information part of it, the public relations part of it.
So it's in solidarity with Moms for Housing.
And I was just gonna say that group, Mothers for Housing, also had a crew, a ground crew, I always call it, the crew that surrounded them when the police threatened them, that was there for days and days and days. Although they were arrested, but the City Council of Oakland was so embarrassed, and the sympathy they generated was so thorough that guess what happened as soon as they were arrested? That company, the City of Oakland, came together and created a kind of conservancy. And that is now housing today. Housing.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It took all those elements to create the safety and the legal set, the legal arguments. They lost in court, but they won the war. They won the housing.
I just wanted to share that with you
because it's not something everyone would risking arrest. Yeah. And it's not, you know...
We've got to do something here. And I know there's people that would be willing to occupy those houses, live in those houses, and see, you know, where it goes.
Uh-huh.
We've already addressed City Council, and we told them that we're going to do that, and we're going to follow, you know, Oakland's lead.
Can I just say one thing about the rental standard too? Because you said something about, you know, there's supposed to be standards as far as rentals and like tiny
homes
don't conform to that.
Yeah,
I have noticed in my personal experience that I don't know about percentage wise, and this could be incorrect, but I would say most of our rentals here fall under a substandard category too, and landlords are totally getting away with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I went 8 months without a hot water heater, and there's basically no enforcement. Like, if you are, there's nobody to protect the renter, even now, tiny house or not. Like, you can call code enforcement. They barely show up. They don't do anything. Right. A lot of people are being victimized by their landlords, and ultimately your only, like, reprieve is to move to another substandard unit.
Well, there's another thing you can do.
I got to take my son home, y'all.
Okay.
I'll see y'all later.
Really nice to meet you.
You too.
Yeah, really.
Thank you for coming.
A pleasure, yeah.
I definitely want to talk to you more about
that.
Okay.
Some simple tenant protections and an actual standard that is being enforced would go a long way.
Uh-huh. Well, we have... Oh, go ahead.
What is the smallest size that fits the habitability standard for a tiny house?
You know, I can't remember what it is, but it's on the California website.
8x12?
It's for rental room. There is a set amount. You can't make smaller.
Is there a size on it, or is it just as long as it has these things?
No, there's a size on it. And there's a size on jails, too. Yeah. Yeah.
I think, Anthony, you had something you wanted to add about the mom's problem.
Well, I think it's a more complicated situation than what we've heard. I think that's part of the picture, but
sure.
I think it calls for a little bit more of a discussion.
That's just one option I'm illustrating. I didn't mean to say that's what everyone does, if that's the impression I lent you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, what I was saying was that I think it's what happened with the occupation of that house for 2 months fired the imagination of the country, of the world, really. They got the call to attention to the fact that there was 4,000 homes sitting vacant in the city of Oakland. And it's true that the developer that owned that particular house owns many houses, not just in Oakland, but has almost a dozen subsidiaries to the Wedgwood Corporation.
Yeah, it's Wedgwood.
But on the other hand, I think that it's... At the same time that it created the opportunity to call attention to this, the problem and the solution, it was also an opportunity for the mayor and for the owner of that company and certain other players to resolve it in such a manner that after they evicted the women, the families from their home in what was essentially a military operation, mm-hmm. they then got on television and congratulated each other for... In a kind of kumbaya moment, we can all work together to solve housing. They had the very same developer up there. They had the Oakland Community Land Trust representatives, and they had the mayor, who has done absolutely nothing. They sat by and let the judge make the ruling when they could have intervened. They sat by and let a military operation evict those people, essentially
yes, they did.
Terrorize them. And to the extent that there was support, it wasn't sufficient to stop that. So I think we need to have a kind of a sober assessment of what that represented on the one hand, the potential it represented, and yet at the same time reveal how our adversaries can maneuver when they're well positioned to maneuver to guarantee that it doesn't break out in the way that it could have broken out and threatened to break out in a very significant political movement. So I think that, I don't want to say more about it because we have other things to talk about, but I think that we're at a very serious crossroads and fork in the road of this whole struggle, and those that we're going up against in this war against the poor and homeless is a very serious matter, and I think the lessons, a lot of discussion, we're undertaking those discussions now. In fact, the National Union, we're in the process now of issuing a statement about what happened with that whole battle, but we're taking our time to really analyze and get a lot of input and see what actually lessons that can be learned going forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's
oh,
a very
wonderful.
High stakes,
yeah.
very high stakes,
reading it. Yeah.
Very high stakes situation here.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we want to proceed in such a manner as that we learn the right lessons, which I think are plenty from that particular engagement. And going forward, I think it has opened up opportunities, but also exposed real risks and real dangers if we don't build a serious, durable movement. So, you know, I don't want to go too much on it because we've got other things to talk about tonight.
Well, could I talk a little about the habitability things you brought up, if that's okay? Because that also ended up creating an opportunity for, I guess, the group of people that rented the apartment building I'm in with me. When I was, I guess it was in 1990, a friend of mine, I'm a musician, so... calls me up and he goes, are you ready for a, it's kind of a housing struggle. We're planning to go on rent strike, but there's an empty apartment if you want to move in. And I, you know, was in a house that was just too crazy for me. And I said, oh, well, okay. So I moved into the middle of a rent strike that was 5 years of rent strike. And the conditions were really terrible. We're mostly immigrant families in that building. We had 5 languages spoken in that building. Oh, yeah. But really cool people, really great kids. And we really needed to have serious issues addressed. Asbestos.
No.
I didn't have heat. A lot of people didn't have heat. The roof was leaking so bad that on the top floor, this was a big thing with the kids. You could press your finger in and make designs, you know. So we pooled our money in an escrow account. And in the very beginning of this rent strike, we began talking to the city of Berkeley about buying the building with us. Because they had money and we didn't, you know.
Yeah.
And we kept kind of, Nancy Skinner, who's now a state representative, was in on it. Lonnie Hancock, same thing. We had a crew of people who, this was in the 1970s, where the idea of a rent strike wasn't as shocking as apparently it is today, especially if you could document that these were kids living in terrible conditions. And what was going on in Berkeley? Berkeley's so wealthy. Why were these out-of-town landlords? You know, these guys didn't even live there. Well, so we pressured them and gave them such bad publicity that they decided they were going to sell the building, right? So they're going to sell the building. So we I hand-painted everyone hot pink rent strike signs, and we put them in every window of what is 3 stories of a building that also houses the Wells Fargo Bank and has 4 commercial spaces. At the corner of University and San Pablo, which is one of the largest intersections in the city of Berkeley. So these guys lived in either India or like someplace really far away. And they weren't even going to come to see their building be sold. They couldn't figure out why it wasn't selling. Well, it wasn't selling because in those days, if you had a united rent strike in your building, you knew you were looking at years of efforts to try to get those tenants out. And they didn't want to do that. So they decided it would just sell on the courthouse steps, and the only people there were us. Nobody wanted to buy that building and try to shovel these poor immigrant families out into the rain. So in a funny way, it was like the right circumstance because it was so bad. And we were a combination of people with adventure, I don't know, a willingness to take a risk. That was probably me. And then immigrant families who felt like, you know what, I am not moving. I'm too busy. I am working 2 jobs, and my husband's a trucker, and, you know, it ended up being a really good thing to do. And the reason I'm bringing it up is that I've watched, 40 years of the older buildings hollowed out for penthouses and high-end stuff. Is that what's going on here? Because that's what happened to Berkeley. When I went to school, I came there as a freshman in 1972. Man, the minimum wage was $1.25. You could pay rent anywhere. And if you didn't like where you lived, 3 doors down, there was another empty place to live. Jobs were everywhere. If you didn't care if it was a good job, you could get jobs anywhere. This is a different landscape now. And I look at that and I just think, what changed was really allowing people to capitalize and exploit housing. And that is stoppable. You know, we can stop people from, what were you saying at the Huff meeting, that in Finland you got to have this house or that house, but you can't have both, something like that. We can do that. The idea that a company could monopolize so much housing and then just sit on it empty. If that isn't a crime, I don't know what it looks like. Go ahead.
Have you ever heard of MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration?
Could you speak up a little?
Have you ever heard of MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registry of Patents and Trademarks?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's these little series of numbers in mortgages.
Uh-huh.
And this is how they bundle derivatives. So it's a way of sucking off the money, and then when circumstances change, you know, like, you know, the company moved out, you can't pay your mortgage, right? And now they can foreclose. But But legally, they can't. Except that they've got, it, because you signed, and there's a little series of numbers there that you didn't know what they were. You signed away your right to defend yourself against foreclosure. And then they take the goods.
Good heavens.
And so they've taken like millions of properties just like that. In other words, you put the down, you make so many payments, things happen, you can't make the payment, they take the whole. What'd they do? They didn't build the damn house. What'd they do to earn that house? They didn't do shit. They just signed some papers with some formula on it. Mm-hmm. Ken Doss on Facebook goes into this.
Mm-hmm. That sounds interesting.
He's fairly eloquent, and he's spent a lot of time researching it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a book, Home Wreckers, which mm-hmm. I'm reading, and you can see that they systematically looked at the savings and loan crisis to figure out what to do now. And one of the things is they're parking their money in properties. And when we were in Hell's Kitchen, there was all those empty luxury condos with people living at the base of them, and they were completely empty. And I was talking to the guy, Chris, that I was staying with, and he said there was hundreds of thousands of units in New York City that were built with no intention of renting them, just to hold their money. And you could see, like in the savings loan crisis, that's when we started doing those housing takeovers with the union, and we also had Homes Not Jails, and we would go and we'd find out all the buildings in San Francisco that were empty, and if a family owned the house, then we left it alone. But most of the time, it was many different mortgage companies would own it, and we would take those houses, and we would, houses that we couldn't repair because the windows were already taken out or something like that, we'd use those as props to, you know, like as a protest. But then we clandestinely housed people in houses we could control. And we had, according to the book, No Trespassing, we had keys to 400 houses. And we had people living in roughly 100 of the houses at any given time. And there was a lot of conflicts with other low-income people. Like, we had one house in the Fillmore, and we didn't realize that the prostitutes that were using the house had all been arrested. And when they came back, they were really angry that we had the house. And then the people in the house decided that they would let the prostitutes operate out of the first floor, and they would live in the second floor. And then we're like, that might not be a good look. So we weren't too sure what to do with that. And then we had some crackheads come and firebomb another house because they had all been arrested, and they came back, and we were living in it. So we had, like, interesting things. And in this town, it seems like they're building, just like in Manhattan, they're building a lot of luxury condominiums mm-hmm. that don't seem to be selling. And for that one on Pacific, at 53 Pacific, I don't think there's any retail spaces in it, except for the management company. And there's very few of the units are occupied. I believe only the units of the manager is occupied. And I would not be surprised if the old bookstore location will end up being largely vacant. They're talking about leveling Front Street, and it's likely that those buildings will just be are just investment property. There's a company from Southern California that's building that building, and they build similar buildings in Singapore and Paris and so on. So there's something afoot right now with lots of empty properties that are brand new empty.
It's a great way to launder money.
And have money sit somewhere where it's safe.
Well, she can write off for taxes.
I
was wondering, could we have in the announcement about tonight's meeting, there's I'd like to hear a little bit more about the plan or the proposal and a little bit more about what the city's doing with Mills and the idea of the proposed
actions and things like that, if that's appropriate, yeah, from some of the others, and as well as the...
I can give a short review, and then Alicia can also add to it. And Robert, who's been... So basically, Mills is trying to, with the help of Tony Condotti, which is the city attorney, make a proposal that they can get around the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Martin versus Boise, by allowing people, so to speak, to camp on sidewalks and places between the hours of 10 at night and 7 in the morning. But they're also proposing to make the downtown, the area on Civic Avenue from the clock tower to probably Laurel, but I don't know, they haven't really said exactly, a park.
It's a park.
Which means they can do stayaway orders and trespass orders. And the other thing that they're proposing seriously is, instead of giving you a ticket, you can opt to work for the police department for free. And so that's kind of the main points of it. At the same time, it appears that Chief Mills is planning a tour of the town to get popular support for this idea.
That's not all.
In March.
That's not all. It also includes, if you're caught sleeping in the same location two times in a row, that it will turn into a misdemeanor. What was the other? There's several parts.
There's one in there that they can arrest you instead of giving you a ticket if you are considered indigent.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he has seven goals in this thing he's put out as a power. I'll give you.
He's
a copy
claiming
of
it's to target nuisance behaviors.
Which was that one? What number was that?
That's number six.
The end.
Number six.
Yeah, recalcitrant behaviors.
Yeah, and he's caught. And when he's been speaking at public events so far, there's a thing called CASH, which has these every other week of public meeting, and then they have these like committees, and they had gave a presentation. And Chief Mills was there. The planning department's always there. Butler's always there. And they went on about how this would be a great thing.
They also want to make Westcliff Drive paid parking.
Yeah.
They've been doing a one-year study without announcing it to the public that they've been surveying all of us and how long we park there to try to come up with some sort of, you know, this is an acceptable amount of time to park.
Wow.
Or you should pay if you park in these lots.
They're also, Mills has been claiming that they're not violating Martin v. Boise, Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, because they are giving trespassing tickets and stay-away orders from parks and
but not camping.
But they don't give camping, so
right,
therefore they're not violating. But the Martin v. Boise, and they're actually criminalizing, virtually everybody outside.
Yep.
And they're massively ticketing vehicles that people live in. And Mills had a press conference where he brought the TV out to Delaware, where a lot of people were sleeping near, like, abandoned University of California buildings on one side of the street, and there's the state park on the other side. And many people have been parking there because they don't want to park in front of people's houses. And they just systematically write you tickets. They've been ticketing people at the Little Red Church, in the parking lot next to the Little Red Church, Calvary Episcopal. I've known a number of friends lost their homes to tickets at that location. So it's a pretty systematic war. On the way here, they were a lot of police on the levee, IDing everybody on the levee, and with lots of police cars and ranger cars and so on. So this is like it's an all-out war. So then another part of our strategy, we took over where Ross Camp had been behind Ross, and we organized a camp called Camp Phoenix, named for the ashes of Desiree, who died after she was evicted from Ross Camp, and she was the named plaintiff in the federal lawsuit. And so we actually showed, huh?
So I'm going to jump in here and fast forward this in a second.
Yeah.
So with all that being said, we've asked the city to support our next move. They are not currently doing that. Even with our new mayor, he has not come forth and said, hey, I want to support this. I recognize the city lied last time and we need a place for everyone. So the homeless union in Santa Cruz is planning, like, now, what do we do about that? It's not really a good look to sit around and wait while people die and, you know, please support us, and they're like, and everyone just keeps dying. So what do? We need to plan another direct action. We need, like you were saying, Moms for Housing has a hub of people willing to get arrested, willing to surround the place. That's kind of what I'm hoping for right now. I'm looking for a core group that's willing to help us in the next direct action and discussing what that should be.
Right now, of course, there is an encampment at the post office.
There's a small encampment. I call it kind of mini Camp Phoenix because we have homeless union people there. Our union officers, Russ and Cooper, are there. And so they're kind of the hub of the camp at the post office right now. I've been driving donations to that camp, but it's a small camp. They're lining the whole post office. I don't know, 8 or 9 maybe.
A little more.
In the porch?
No, they're along the side.
But in the city, most people know the numbers are skewed, but 800 citywide, at least 2,000 countywide, counting city and county. And so 8 tents at the post office, whether or not they're left alone, is not a direct action. That's not, you know, a political move on our part to try to get some policy change around here. So, like, that's what we're discussing. What do we do now? Do we reopen Camp Phoenix and surround it by people locking arms? Do we start putting tiny homes and say, do not touch these because you're not offering another solution? Like, that's kind of where we're going. Like, we need to come up with our next political move.
There's also, which I was called you last night, but I didn't reach you. So this cash meeting thing doesn't ever, they don't ever talk about ultimately doing anything. They're like a way of getting do-gooders to think that the city's doing something. So they voted to have this committee to discuss solutions for homelessness on the same night as they voted to evict Ross Camp, which is very similar to what they did before when, after 2 years of a sleep out called Freedom Sleepers, they finally, Don Lane, who was backed by the recall, announced that he was willing to remove the word sleep from the camping ban so that you could be arrested if you had a blanket or a tent or a tarp, but if you were just sleeping outside, so they only got 2 votes for that.
But that seems to be the practical thing they're doing now. As long as you don't have a tent, if you're sleeping outside, unless you're sleeping outside for any length of time other than a day or two, then they will, to some extent, tolerate you unless, of course, some neighbor complains, which happens all the time.
I have some.
before you do, the issue we've been having about what to do, as you've been saying, Alicia, another second Camp Phoenix, is in order to establish a Camp Phoenix, you need people to want to come to it with some sense of security that they're actually not going to be swept away 2 days later by the police, which they likely are. That's the problem. And you also need, perhaps, as you were saying, the idea that, well, if you get a bunch of people from the community to link arms around them, which is a difficult thing to organize, but could be done, then maybe the police act, maybe they don't. But once they do act, if they act, will people come back again? Given
that's
the
circumstances. That's why we're here talking.
Right. That's then what
I'm not
criticizing.
Psychic.
I'm saying that's the dilemma.
Could I offer, if I may, one of the things that I guess this You know, having people sleeping in doorways in Berkeley has been going on a long time. But when I first came as a college kid, you know, this is 1972, this is seriously the culture of Berkeley, that if you saw somebody sleeping in a doorway, and I used to do this all the time. I mean, my whole household did this. I lived in one of these shared houses. You'd go over and say, hey, buddy, how you doing? Are you okay? You want a bowl of soup, you know? And we always had, it seemed like it was just really accepted that you did that, that you reached out to the stranger. Maybe they took something at the Grateful Dead show and they're still getting it through their system. Whatever their story was, you took a chance on them, and that was the culture. I have to say, because...
That's not the culture here.
Well, but it has changed in Berkeley as well. I guess that's why I wanted to speak up and say,
yeah.
I think those of us who remember can help recover it. And
now
I
the
think,
culture is kick them and say, are you a dope? Get a job!
Well, that probably was happening, you know, in 1972 as well. But what I know I was a part of was, and there were religious groups, and we still have religious groups, neighborhood groups, and groups like Friends of Adeline. They are a combination of businesses who are sick to death of having all the business groups be fascist. They thought, not us, we are not fascists. And we know that racism has played a role in this. And South of Adeline, that matters. So what I'm saying is that ground crew, I think, is out there. And we need to build it. We need to build it in Berkeley, bigger than it is, because it's helped make inroads in this tightening, that thing where they just take the legislation and they make it worse, and they make it worse, and they make it worse. And then they do what they want anyway, right?
I had a question.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to say, building that ground crew is worth doing. It's not everything, but it's worth doing. And part of the theater that I do and the music that I do is about exactly that. People will, it's a small ratio of any group that collects around theater or collects around music or dance. But that small ratio of people is a powerful, powerful group of people. They're influential. When you meet one, and you will, when you meet one or two, make sure you sit and talk to them and talk about what they can give and make a connection. I just think it has built some of the most powerful things we've done. Just having this handful of people who, they not only care, they really want an ally. They want an ally with your group on the street, and they want an ally in the arts.
The question I had for you is this. One of the things that we wanted to find out at this meeting, we invited another woman to come down with you, and there was a possibility of her coming. Andrea Henson, who's working with the Where Do We Go encampment, which is standing off the Caltrain authorities, and that might be a lesson for some of us trying to do
Let me talk about that.
A second camp.
So in Berkeley,
in
Berkeley, there's, you know, the highway goes along the inside of the bay, and the freeway curls off of it and goes straight up University Avenue. Well, the underpasses over there are a great way to get out of the rain. So people have always been living down there, as long as I've lived in Berkeley, and that's since 72. But, of course, over the years, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And only about, I swear, it's only about 10 years ago, they decided Caltrans was either pressured to or decided to do these sweeps where, well, you can live here, but you got to move everything you own and, you know, back and forth, back and forth. And there came a moment, it was only about a year ago, where they said, you know what, we can't do that anymore. We can't move because we have people who are too sick to pack everything up routinely and move back and forth and back and forth. And that the Where Do We Go was born out of that. There are four tents that have that little lights inside, and you can read it illuminated all night long. It's beautiful. I mean, it's gorgeous art. Where do we go? And it's an essential question.
Because it used to be hippies and things like that that were mostly the homeless population, and now it's elderly and disabled people who are on SSI and can't even afford a room.
Right.
And
so Andrea, reason Andrea isn't here tonight, she wanted to come down with me, and I so wanted to talk to her all the way down. But a woman got badly burned in that camp, some accident with a fire, really badly burned. And so the city decided to make room for her in what they call this Stairway Pathway Center. It's like a super shelter that they built down by the dump. And they get you out of the rain all right, but it doesn't, you know. Down by the dump. The thing is, she's oriented, and when she came to, she got up, and without even her shoes on, she walked back out, all the way back out, over the train tracks, and out to the underpass, because that was her home. So Andrea went down and found her standing in the mud, and finally coaxed her to come back, because she's at such risk of infection. And that's why she's not here. She's trying to make sure she stays with her while she goes through this adrenalized disorientation.
So I wanted to note that the facilitator, who is like has an iron fist of the CASH program, is a guy by the name of Fred Keeley. And he was a state assembly person and the treasurer of the county. And
he's the current treasurer of the county, according to his LinkedIn page.
Yeah. So he lived, so there's a building right next to his very fancy, beautiful Victorian house, which everybody was evicted out of it because it was a restaurant and it was not zoned housing, even though their employees lived in these apartments there. So one potential idea is to move into that building or to start living in the parking lot and stuff around there. And be interesting to see how Fred would react to that. And if that would have any...
Just move into Fred's house. Nice and big.
Yeah, move into Fred's house. But so anyway, that's just a potential target.
So wouldn't you call this policies of attrition? Like a war of attrition?
Yeah, just like that.
So using that kind of language, see, that takes it to a different level. Attrition is a term for sieging, for place, doing a siege against a castle or something. You starve it out by attrition. But their attrition is to keep you moving out. Don't stop here, keep moving. Meanwhile, you ain't got the money to move. You know, you can't afford, and you don't even know where to go. So, you know, that's a policy of attrition. Now, churches are supposed to be sanctuaries. We get tax breaks for being sanctuaries. What does the word sanction under the law and sanctuary have in common? Like, if churches are sanctuaries, how come they aren't functioning
as
sanctuaries?
Is that why they get the tax break?
Linda?
Thank you. I wanted to say something else about Fred Keeley that really belongs in a circle like this. I was at one of their meetings one time. Keith and Alicia were there too, and right after you two left, and I made another comment, Keeley is, for those of you who don't understand this city advisory board's marching orders, they're paying $30,000 to Fred Keeley, granted one of the best facilitators I've ever seen in action, but to help the CASH, who are volunteers working for the city in this role, do their parliamentary procedure, because it was new to some of them. But at that particular meeting, Fred went on for about 5 minutes about he doesn't agree with my definition of what criminalization means. And he went on to say how he defines it, and it is so narrow it almost makes Condotti look like he has a heart.
Wow.
And so I think you people need to know it. And if anybody ever wanted to formalize their concern about how the CASH, I call it CASH, not CASH, committee is being influenced by Keeley's work, I would sign on to it too. With this.
Not to mention putting the chief of police in charge of policy.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, that's like martial law or something.
Exactly.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm so glad to hear that. That's a good story.
Thank you.
So, you made a great point, Carol, putting the chief of police in charge of policy.
Well, before Andy was here, he cleaned up Eureka. And before Andy was in Eureka, he cleaned up San Diego. So we're
so he was hired to deal with the homeless issue. Wow.
We're approaching
that's
this
really
from a really low point and not seeing a 35-year plan.
Good night. Thanks for coming.
Night. Good night.
Please call me.
You know,
Baby,
it's
every time I start speaking.
It's nothing personal.
They were getting ready before you.
If they did before you.
So
I would like to say it's time for Santa Cruz to try something different, like
thank you,
Oakland, like Berkeley. Find an empty church.
Something
find
radical.
A big building that's empty, that's out of town owners, just like they.
Well,
all these places.
They're not doing that now. We did that.
Okay, I know, but move in. Yeah. I'm talking about the moms for housing.
Well, that's Oakland.
Okay.
Yeah.
That, Oakland. The strategy. Yes.
They were driven to the wall.
I'm ready for something radical. I need help.
That's the sentiment around here.
Well,
yeah.
I think that we are in a situation. I'm going back to what Alicia said that. When she was describing how people are living in substandard housing, there are people one step away or in and out of homelessness.
That's why I'm homeless. Just
yeah, I'm not sure how many students in this county are homeless, but in Ventura County there are 6,000 homeless students, the official number, and the exact same number in Monterey County. There are farm workers living in chicken coops in Salinas. And the housing and homelessness crisis is very broad. And I think that if we're going to make a plan to do what we're talking about here, then we need to take into consideration seeing to it that if we're going to do this, that we're in a position to bring those reserves out. Otherwise, they're going to be able to, no matter how, I think what we need to do is not just be a small group fighting harder, but be a group that is able to make a political counteroffensive. And a counteroffensive is not just a small group fighting harder. It's reaching out to see who naturally is in line and in league with what we're talking about here, because we're going to take up for them too.
Sure, but it's never either or. Sorry, you're presenting it as either or, and that's never the case.
Ma'am, if you don't mind, could I continue?
Please do.
Okay, I'm simply trying to make the point that. If we're going to do this, and I think we need to get down to the business of planning it, some of which can be done here, some of which has to be done after we leave here or as a process, that we need to take into consideration that what the police will do and have done, what are our reserves and our resources, because it's what we're generally failing to do, I think, in terms of this whole struggle around the country and in California, is I think we're insufficiently failing to appreciate how broad the homeless crisis is. And therefore, we're kind of going where the light shines the brightest, but it's not necessarily where we're going to be able to make a real movement, a movement that's able to impose its will on some very powerful adversaries. So I think we need to do what we're talking about, and we can do it. And what we did with Camp Phoenix is very dramatic, and they closed it down. After saying for 5 days they had no legal basis to close it down because it was a political threat. And they realized it was a political threat because the union set it up. It was safe. It was 75 to 100 people were there.
They couldn't have that.
And they couldn't have that. So what I'm trying to say is I'm just suggesting that as part of the planning for this that we have an outreach component to see to it that when that day comes and we anticipate what our adversary is going to do and we're ready for it by... Even if we lose, we'll increase the number of people that are part of what we're doing on an ongoing basis.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to point out that there's nothing that stops anyone from organizing locally, but also being well informed about what is happening nationally and making sure that if you can, work as I have for years, work north-south in California and also broadly across the nation where I go to West Virginia a lot, which has had the same change as Berkeley has had. So building coalition is wonderful and doing outreach is wonderful. And it is not in opposition to the work that you do for your neighbor, you know, behind the dumpster.
This is why we haven't done, just real quick, why we haven't done anything yet, because we want it to be planned and calculated, and we want people to be on board.
But I think that the whole purpose
maybe of this meeting to begin with, is where are the reserves and resources, and how can we build that public will and get more people on that side of it that are going to be there for, you know, anyone that does get arrested or anyone that does have a camp to do the linking of arms or do the support of the arrested or people willing to be arrested, housed people.
I have a suggestion. Yeah, I just wanted to say that's where art and music can play a role. And I'm just going to tell you one more thing that we did that was kind of like the kiddie pool and sitting there in our bathing suits with plastic lobsters. It was called the Cherapillar. And this was a way, I kept thinking, you know, you can have a march, right? You can have a march against homelessness. But, you know, some of us are old and tired, and like you have, even if you bring your bike, you go 3 miles that way. I just thought, isn't there anything else we can do that will be as visual, but be a little more comfy? And I thought, I know what it is. Everybody bring a chair. So the people I knew who were adventurous and interested in opposing our proposed anti-sitting law. We're supposed to bring a chair to the middle of our public plaza by our BART station. And the idea was, you know, you put your chairs in a row, and then the person who is at the back end of whichever way the Cherapillar is going picks up the chair and walks with it and puts it at the front. And this thing is really slow, but it slowly moves and slowly moves all over your downtown, and everybody has a sign that says "Stand up for the right to sit down," and makes it, we had the greatest jokey signs, and then little flyers, so that as people pass by, you're doing a flyer, and you look very together, and you look like you're having fun, you're not asking for money. What you're doing is raising awareness. Out of that group ends up growing connections that you can build on. It's just, these goofy ideas end up mattering a lot. Like the coffee thing that you guys are planning to do, that's really a great way, and especially have a flyer saying we'd love to connect with you, ways for them to connect with you.
Can we real quick, because I never know, like in the room, like we have meetings, but I really don't know as far as when we're sitting around in a circle, who am I currently sitting with? Like what are you willing to or can you put in? Are you willing to be an organizer? Are you willing to make phone calls? Are you willing to get arrested? Are you willing to join a protest? Like, can we just maybe go around real quick and say, you know, like, I'll start. My name's Alicia. I'm willing to organize, march, protest. Under the right conditions, I'd even be willing to get arrested, even though I have a job. So it'd have to be really the right circumstance and the right political situation, and I'd be willing to make a stand like that.
Yeah.
Willing to get arrested, Keith? What's up?
At a certain point, for sure, but not until I'm a little further along in my book. But I also wanted to say one thing Anthony was talking about. There's two interesting things that are happening right now. One is the strike is building to include a lot more people. At some point, that strike is going to succeed, and it's around the issue of housing, the UC Santa Cruz strike. The second thing is on March 3rd, it's extremely likely that we're going to get two anti-homeless city councilors, and that whole recall community people will be deflated as a result of that, but maybe amongst that group, because the purpose of the recall is because they stood up, they're claiming it's because the two city councilors, this is their like elevator talk that they're running right now, supported Ross Camp. And so it's around the issue of exactly what we're talking about. So there's a possibility we could right now, but not deflate the movement to stop the recall, but to be overtly building alliances with that community to get them involved in what we're doing. And then the other thing was that to make it safe for people to risk arrest, we have been proposing the idea of there being a support person for two or three or four people willing to get arrested who already know the details of that person, whether they, you know, their birthday, whether they got a, you know, their belongings need to be taken care of, they've got a job that needs to be called, those kind of things. And then hopefully, like you're starting to make some connections with the National Lawyers Guild, and maybe there's a way of trying, of actually at the next meeting, encouraging a discussion specifically around what the strategy is, and also, like what Alicia just saying, who's willing to risk arrest and who's willing to be a support person, and how is that going to be organized, and maybe we can start to pull in more of the striking students and workers, mm-hmm. and more of the recall people, and potentially more of the Bernie people, because also on the third, there's no longer, now you're organizing around a national presidential campaign, but they are also sympathetic. So it's a maybe a larger coalition of people, because the focus is on these anti-homeless attacks, even involving housed people who are now, you know, they have like large meetings of people. I mean, they filled that auditorium with Bernie people.
Yeah, man.
At some point, it'd be easier for me to organize things too if I knew, like, I have, you know, 50 marchers. I have 100 protesters. I have, you know, 40 people willing to be arrested. Like, you know what I mean? If we could put numbers and faces and phone numbers and really get some real solid organization going on.
Well, one thing you might want to do, we did this with the poor people.
Is it your turn?
2 years
Is it
ago.
Your turn?
We don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Are you done?
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Me?
No. Are we going around in a circle?
I think Kevin.
I have no idea. I'm Kevin. I'm all in.
You ready to be arrested?
Hi. I'm James Ewing Whitman. I'm more than willing to be arrested. I'm really quite a seeker. I do at least 4 hours of research every day, and I'm constantly listening to stuff. So I've gone to Extinction Rebellion a bunch of times, but nothing on their list is part of my 13 things that are going to turn Earth into Mars. I'm so concerned about my safety that I'm engaging with law enforcement and interviewing law enforcement, so much that law enforcement avoids me. I've sat with the chief of police. I was the only one, I think, in this room that was at his talk on the 15th.
James, we're losing people.
You know what? We've lost a lot of people. You know, I'm concerned for everybody's safety. And I'm suggesting a class action lawsuit that both the dozens of citizens who have spoken about the EMF damage and the building, the $35 million building right across the street, to get some action. And I've gone to these meetings many times. And I'm really frustrated because you guys don't see the big picture, which is that we're going
to
smash.
She asked a question about who wanted to provide
I'm willing
support.
To get arrested.
Right.
I'm willing to get shot in the back of the head.
Yeah, you could have said that, but we are good. I'm glad you are. So am I.
Put everyone in on what they can.
But we have lost four people while you were speaking.
Okay, that's right. Let's just
well, I'm blaming you on the
though. Maybe we should need to ask questions at the beginning of the meeting.
It's so would you like to say something?
Oh, yeah, turns.
Anthony, what are you
doing? Yeah, well, of course, you know,
been what's happening with
before,
the lawsuit?
We'll be arrested again. And from the standpoint of whatever the local union here does, we have a California Homeless Union statewide organizing council. We'll marshal our reserves and our resources that we have, as we have been doing all along with the whole battle from Ross Camp on. So, yeah, you can...
What's happening with the lawsuits?
Well, what...
I want to know that first, because you're a friend, you know what's going on, I'd like to know that before
But we're
you.
In the middle of a process.
I know. I have a simple question, though, before you...
We'll talk about it afterwards.
Well, the wrongful death lawsuit is confidential between her son and her counsel, though.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of... There is threats of more lawsuits, yes.
Hi, I'm Bree. I don't know if I'm ready to be arrested.
Okay. You
There's
might
no
be a support person.
You might not even know right now, and that's fine.
Yeah.
What's your name again? I'm sorry. Bree?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Don't think I'm ready to be arrested, but I'm down to organize, I'm down to phone call, I'm down
All
to
right.
protest, I'm
cool.
down to
Thank party. You.
Why not? Thank you.
Okay. Well, here's mine. Right now, as I sit here, I could not risk being arrested. But none of the times I've been arrested were pre-planned, so I wouldn't want to be left off the list either. My highest concern about that is my own immune system, and that my rent's it's not past due. Beyond that, I'd certainly try it on. But what I can do, it sounds feeble compared to the risks that come with jail, is I have a lot of training in public relations. I don't even have a phone at home, but I'm highly trained in telephone, with or without a script, selling. And I could help call these, pardon the bad word, liberal people that need to know about this more. And I also, this is just for my own self, but it'd be great to get a co-sponsor, like say the Santa Cruz chapter of the Homeless Union. I want to do a little workshop sometime in the month of my birthday, which is April. We could do it sooner if I had the means. How to write a powerful lead for your public relations effort. My background is writing, not broadcast media, but I've had enough of a taste of free radio to know how that's different linguistically. And it's a set of skills that should be shared more.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Jean. I guess I'd be willing to be arrested and some sort of support. You know, I'm a conflicted person because I like to look at all sides, really. So a lot of times you see me, a lot of times you don't. But, you know, for me, the Oakland Moms Movement was dynamite because, you know, it's so easy to disregard so many people we pass day after day. And I live downtown, and I'm not shy about talking to folks. But how to really sink it in with the general public who's turned a blind eye to folks, you know. And so that's another part of it. The women on the street and the folks in wheelchairs and all that. I mean, it's hard to not have some empathy, particularly around those issues. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, put myself out there.
All right. Thank you.
You know, when you do that list next time, you could kind of
Yeah, maybe we should have a box on that. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, I'm not willing to get arrested because I have responsibilities watching my grandkids. But I work with two groups already, and one is in the process of writing grants for different, you know, projects, and it's called WILF. Do any of you know WILF?
Yeah.
Oh, you know WILF. Okay. And so we're at our next meeting, we're going to give some suggestions for grants. Okay. I have been really involved in the immigration thing, and I was thinking of writing a grant from that, but homeless is also dear to my heart. And I'm also a member of a church that's with the Interfaith Coalition, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, people that camp at our church at night in the parking lot and people that sleep and we feed.
Right.
And we need to expand that. Like you said, it's a sanctuary. Do you know churches are really disappearing now? There's a lot of huge empty church buildings. For God's sake, there is that could be used. You know, but I like the idea more of the Moms Oakland thing. Find a mortgage, you know, bank-owned, out-of-town place that could be used. And the out-of-town banks or the out-of-town owners that are using it for a tax write-off, you know, we could maybe find something like that, because that really inspired me, the Oakland.
It did start a movement.
Yes, it did. And we need to try something different. I'm tired of the campgrounds getting moved from place to place to place. That's just, it's not a good strategy. You know, but that's what we have. So anyway.
There we go. Yeah, you know, to pass people through, they have to know where they're going or what's there. In other words, in the old days in the Catalyst Service, these columns where people would leave their sticker notes. People would walk in there and find other people. So it was like a central information.
Switchboard.
Yeah, it's switchboard. And to cue people as to what opportunities there were in other parts of the town, California, so it was the information. But part of the principle of sanctuary is that information, because sanctuary is fire. Fire creates created speech. Speech created human beings. We used to sit around the fire. Now we're in a cubic grid system, like the black cube, very Masonic. The cops are all Masons, right? Almost all, I mean, Masonic thing.
I doubt it.
A lot of them have Mason patches on. But anyway, the Masons are very ancient and old order.
What can you do? Yeah.
The white hand of the Masons were the ones who were the transcendentalists that created our...
What are you offering to do, Brian?
What am I offering to do?
If you are. I mean,
maybe create a fountain of poetic intelligence.
Oh, right. That's pretty creative.
Bathe under the tree.
I don't know if I'd be willing to be arrested, but I could do phone stuff, you know, more support.
And I guess I'll remind those of us who are left that a few of us are going to go down on Tuesday morning and, you know, do a little coffee clutching, maybe with Joe Schultz's coffee or some soup, and hang out outside the city manager's office and maybe advertise and try to get more people to get involved in supporting what you're looking for, Alicia. Another camp, another church occupation, another charathon, whatever it is. In other words, the next action that involves this. And I might also say that next week, at a little bit earlier than this time, this group can meet again because we have space at the Sub Rosa Cafe, which is, if people know where the Sub Rosa is, anybody not know where that is? You know, it's next to the bike church, 703 Pacific. It'll be at, we can't do it at 4:30, we have to do it earlier at 3:15. So that, I'll be around at 3:15 at the Sub Rosa next Wednesday if anybody shows, and then on Monday. So, I mean, Tuesday at outside Martine Bernal's office at City Hall.
So we have, like, phone numbers from last week, and there were a bunch of people that didn't come this week, but were seemed very interested in doing some direct action or support or risking arrest. We need somebody to call everybody on both that list, the earlier list, because a long time ago we had a meeting here with a lot of support. And so somebody, it would be really valuable if people could call to let people know about next week's meeting.
I'm still not any closer to knowing what my next direct action is. Hmm? We're not any closer to knowing what our next direct action is, though.
Yeah, well, between that, I mean, we need to discuss that more. And we need to get more, I'm thinking maybe next week we have, like, intentionally divide up into teams that know who's going to be arrested and who's going to be their support person, and also talk about the strategy of what it is we want to do. And between now and then, maybe we can just generally talk amongst ourselves with ideas like we've been having. We need to talk to people at the meal about getting involved, like Crystal and her whole network and so on, and see what they're interested in doing, and hopefully I know they work. That's part of the problem. A lot of people that are really key to what we're doing work, even though they live at the shelter and so on. So it's just kind of...
Are we doing Wednesday at 4:30 again?
Wednesday at 3:45?
3:15
at Sub Rosa, which is going to be a problem for you because you've got work.
Well, let me know how this meeting goes.
Yeah. And then the next week we'll be back here again.
2 weeks from today?
Yeah, 2 weeks from today we'll be back here. It's just that next Wednesday this room is being used. And we need this room because we like to do food because... people miss dinner if we don't bring food. So anyway, yeah.
Does anybody left in the room know some UCSC students personally or otherwise?
Well, I think one was right there.
Oh, I think how did you know? But you?
Yeah, I work at the university and I work directly with a lot of students.
Oh, far out.
Oh, you're perfect. Because we should be inviting different groups of college students, including people that might be critical. Can you help with that?
Yeah.
Cool.
I've got to get going because I haven't been home since 7.
But yeah, we should. So
I got a question that I'd like to ask before we go, which is again, I asked you this before, Anthony, because I think one of the key spurs to the group that actually has been working on this was the lawsuit that you helped advise us with, and you helped spearhead, and you spent hours and hours of your time doing that. I'm wondering, is that on the horizon at all? At what stage is it? And if it's not, that's okay. We're going to proceed, as you pointed out, it's organizing as well as legal that's important. But where are we with that right now?
Well, you know, we have the same position that we took at the outset, which was that the union, we have a very microscopic legal department, even though we more recently have some opportunities to expand, I think, significantly the number of attorneys who are willing to come in, and not just attorneys, but other members of the legal profession, legal activists, law students. And that is that if we can't find legal counsel to file, in this case, from everything I've heard described, there may be a possibility of filing some kind of motion for a preliminary injunction if we can show, once again, what the elements are. And what we did last time is assist the pro se lawsuit. We're willing to do that again. What we talked about at the close of when that lawsuit was dismissed finally in the federal court was that we had amassed significant evidence, and that evidence is still usable.
Yeah.
And the idea was to document the harm that we predicted would happen. Now, with Desiree's death, that was a very dramatic example of precisely the harm that we tried to advise the court and warn the court would happen if they did not issue the injunction, and it happened. And we know of other harms that have happened since then. So if we can aggregate that evidence, and if we can show that these harms are continuing and that there will be irreparable harm if the city pursues these policies, not going to wait for these policies to be implemented, if we can show that they're imminent and that they will cause harm, then there's a possibility of proceeding into court again, and I think we'll be in a much stronger position this time around because we will have a little bit more time.
What kind of help do you feel you need to do this effectively?
Well, I think we should probably organize again what we did prior to that back in March, March and April, where we had a class on how to file. I don't think you were there, Robert, but we had a class. We had the first one over at the camp. We had a subsequent one that was indoors.
That was
the whole process.
Right, I saw it on
TV. Yeah, right. So we should do that again now with the experience we gained in the last round. But I think that you won't have to convince me. Litigation can be an important tool.
Do you have time to come and give such a class?
I always have time to come teach a class.
What's your availability the next time?
Well, I got to check my calendar, but we could pull together. If we make a commitment to doing it, we have people that are ready to work on it, then we'll be there.
Thank you.
Yeah, and hopefully bring some more legal counsel, legal talent on board.
You can always find me there on Facebook.
Is it not helpful that Santa Cruz is taking policy direction from a chief of police who has a particularly interesting anti-homeless bias in two other cities?
He cleaned up.
Is that
useful? He cleaned up San Diego.
Is that legally helpful?
I'm not sure what you mean legally helpful. I mean, we're seeing this everywhere. We're seeing where the same thing is happening in Marysville, Yuba County, where the head of the homeless consortium, Continuum Care, is the chief of police, Chris Sachs. He's the guy who in 2016 was a lieutenant, oversaw the destruction of 7 homeless encampments on the Yuba River. He's now head of the homeless consortium developing policy.
Right.
Same thing here, Andy Mills. Chief. This is the pattern. This is why we're talking about a war. We're talking about a real, you know, a strategy of our adversaries to empower directly the police departments, and now they're forming policy. They're actually shaping and informing the legislative process. So it's a real serious issue that we're going to have to discuss and contend with. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, Andy Mills is actually in charge of the city until FEMA or the UN take over.
Yeah.
Unless Andy is already part of that.
Unless Andy
is already part of FEMA or the UN, which is entirely possible.
Are we
just don't know.
Yeah. Are we in charge now?